Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here in KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls.
We start off our episode with some news and call-in information.
Prison Legal News reports that Arthur Longworth is serving life without parole at the Monroe Correctional Complex in Washington State. Since he was first incarcerated 35 years ago, Longworth has published stories and essays. Recently, he published a novel he'd worked on for more than a decade entitled Zeke, An American Prison Story. The novel is for sale on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at a few bookstores. However, in October, the Washington Department of Corrections banned the book. As a result, inmates who ordered it will not receive their copies. On the same day as the banning, the teacher who had smuggled the manuscript out of the prison and to a publisher received a letter from the prison officials informing him he could no longer set foot in the prison because he demonstrated undue familiarity by helping with, quote, an offender's book, unquote. As Prison Legal News notes, this case is just a reminder that some First Amendment rights still do not apply to prisoners.
People are asking for help with a call-in to support Texas prisoners. These prisoners were retaliated against by guards after they allegedly participated in the national prison strike. If you want, you can call the Alfred Hughes Unit in Texas at 254-865-6663. A suggested script could be, I heard on September 9th that guards in riot gear showed up and blasted tear gas and physically restrained and assaulted several prisoners, and also shot them with pellet guns. Can you confirm that this is true, and can you explain the directives that you rely on to make the decision to implement such actions against these prisoners?
According to a Sentencing Law and Policy news release, on October 30th, three organizations issued a report titled The $3.4 Trillion Mistake, The Cost of Mass Incarceration and Criminalization, and How Justice Reinvestment Can Build a Better Future for All. The report states that over the last three decades, the U.S. emphasis on mass incarceration and criminalization policies wasted $3.4 trillion that could have been used instead to create living wage jobs, improve educational opportunities for youth, and hire mental health and drug treatment counselors. The report's key recommendations include, first, inclusive efforts at the federal, state, and local levels to reduce all four areas of surplus justice spending, police, corrections, judicial, legal, and immigration enforcement, and reinvestment of those funds in meeting critical community needs. Second, creation of a new federal justice reinvestment fund to dramatically expand the support and incentives for states and municipalities to engage in comprehensive justice reinvestment efforts. And last, state-level support and incentives for local governments to engage in comprehensive justice reinvestment efforts.
We've spoken before about kinetic justice and the Free Alabama movement. Recent reports from the Free Alabama movement state that incarcerated organizer Kinetic Justice is being denied water by prison officials at the Kilby Correctional Facility. We recently reported that Justice was transferred to Kilby, also known as the Bully Unit, after he helped launch a nationwide prison strike. Since October 21st, he's been on hunger strike to protest this transfer. Justice says that prison officials have now turned off the water in his cell. If you want to call and show support for Kinetic Justice, you can please show your support by calling Holman Correctional Facility at 251-368-8173.
Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, the nation's largest private prison company, is changing its name to CoreCivic. The company operates over 70 prisons and houses 70,000 prisoners. Founded in 1983, CCA was the first company to market for-profit prisons. In its early days, one of CCA's founders said, quote, "You just sell incarceration like you were selling cars or real estate or hamburgers," unquote. Alex Friedman, a criminal justice activist and former inmate who served 6 years in a CCA prison, says he thinks CCA's name change is an attempt to distance itself from a damaged brand. CCA's name, he says, has become a liability because of its connection with violence, sexual abuse, corruption, and high costs at its prisons. Friedman added, quote, CCA may have changed its name, but its business model, bad corporate practices, and sordid history remain the same," unquote.
Reports dating October 30th from Alabama's Donaldson Correctional Facility say that James Ware was attacked by corrections officers after being removed to an isolated area of the prison in an obviously planned attack. Mr. Ware was placed into the Hot Bay dorm, which is an isolated and restricted part of the prison where assaults have been frequent in the past. Mr. Ware has been moved to another area of solitary confinement and is being denied a phone call to communicate with his family. If you'd like, you can call Commissioner Jefferson S. Dunn at 334-353-3883 or Warden Leon Billing at 205-436-3681 and demand that Mr. Ware be afforded a phone call to ensure that he is safe and receiving proper medical treatment. Just yesterday, on November 3rd, we received news that violence erupted in Alabama's Donaldson facility when officers retaliated in response to an incident where an officer was stabbed on November 2nd. Several prisoners have been sprayed, beaten, and taken to the infirmary for treatment. We will offer more updates as we have more detailed information.
This week, we return to the experiences and stories of Sekou Kambui, who was incarcerated for 47 years in Alabama prisons. He was originally charged in connection with his Black liberation work in the Deep South. He was a member of the Southern Christian Leadership Council and Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee before joining the Black Panthers and eventually claiming a new African identity. The Republic of New Africa sought autonomy and independence for Black people across the American South. Facing intense persecution, many were sentenced to prison. New Africans became an important current within many prison systems, and not just in the South, but across the U.S. In Indiana, for example, New African prisoners played a key role in prisoner education organizing beginning in the 1980s. As Sekou describes, New African study circles raised the consciousness of whole generations of prisoners and are an important precursor to today's mass prisoners movements. In this interview with James Kilgore, we get a picture of the practices of self-education and jailhouse legal work, which anticipated the contemporary wave of prisoner organization.
I had organizations that I had created, and we had talks about all kind of things, computer literacy classes, typing classes, language classes of one form or another, whether French, Spanish, or Kiswahili. We did lectures and taught individuals public speaking skills, and we gave them morality courses. In other words, learning how to love themselves and respect themselves, and understand that in building relationships around the prison, they need to do it respectfully. And the objective being is that so that when they are finally released from prison, that they would be able to return to society and act like a civilized, mature thinking adult, pretty much.
And so how did you organize these classes? I mean, how were they in the program of the prison? Was that part of a formal education program? Did you do it like in day rooms and yards in free time?
Originally, we would have to do it on the yard and in the day room or in the dorm. We take over 3, 4, 5 beds and sit around and have what we need. But we began to build relationships with the Nation of Islam, with the Sunni community, or Moorish Science. Or we would talk to the chaplain about giving us some space in the chapel. Most of the chapels had extra classroom type areas. And so we would request our organization to be given permission to do what we do. I give him a synopsis, an outline of the program, and our projections on what we would like to develop, what kind of material we'd like to develop to provide a service to the population. Guys need opportunities to sit down and talk. Sometimes we do speaking classes where people exercise their public speaking, newly acquired public speaking skills, and to stand before the class and give a lecture on one topic or another. Hopefully something constructive, hopefully something meaningful. There were times when we do those classes that we would interject spoken word artists. You know, we would allow them in between lectures to do spoken word material. Sometimes even sing, depends on what their skill set was. But it was an opportunity to kind of provide a safe haven for a lot of the youngsters who would otherwise be running around the population loose and free and wild, and get caught up in a lot of foolishness. So whenever I was in a prison, I always tried to create, build my organizations and set up with administration opportunities for having classes and doing programs where we do events like this, you know, bring in people to speak, judges, lawyers, doctors, teachers, you know. Sometimes we was able to arrange with the local colleges to come in and create a lecture series and give the guys an opportunity to, you know, open their mind up to things other than criminal thinking, mm-hmm. you know.
So were there other people besides yourself that kind of had this vision and this approach to how they
right.
did time?
Well, that is how, you know, that was the only way I could be successful, mm-hmm. is to bring to me mm-hmm. individuals, cultivate relationships with individuals that had a mature thinking, mm-hmm. you know, were mature thinking adult kind of people. And we'd sit around and talk, and we'd walk through the institution and evaluate and assess and analyze what was here and what was going on, and how do we do something to bring people into a positive mindset, give them something constructive to address, because the system wasn't really providing a lot of that.
Sure.
In the late, in mid-70s, I won litigation that forced the Department of Corrections to provide educational opportunities, you know, school and college and what have you, trade schools and what have you, ABE schools for acquiring GEDs mm-hmm. and things of that nature. We brought in a program called Lockbox, developed people's reading, writing, and arithmetic skills to the point where they are now able to go and participate in the ABE program towards the acquiring mm-hmm. their GED. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, from one institution to the next, if your proposal to the administration about creating or bringing in such a program is successful, then sometimes the administration themselves would pass it on to other facilities so that they could, you know, continue the program. Pretty much like the government did to the Panthers, you know, they destroyed them and took away opportunities for their free breakfast programs, and then what did they do? And they turn around and create some for themselves so that they could receive the credit for it. So the DOC is pretty much like that. They'll give if you sit around and talk to them and explain your position and what you want to do and what you plan to achieve, they'll look at it and say, okay, we'll give you a chance to see whether or not this will work. And, you know, if it works, then they'll take it and incorporate it as if it was their program.
Right, right.
But the point of it is, it's not a question of who gets credit for it, as long as the job is done.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't really be worried so much about being co-opted in those kind of situations. We felt like that as long as we were able to create some constructive programs that would allow an individual to have an option open to better themselves or improve their attitude or improve their life or their thinking about their lives, and we were very happy with that, mm-hmm. and it kept us motivated, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It kept the challenge of trying to bring something new to each administration was the same, you know. There were those times when we had to have strategy meetings, bring people in, key people around the institution, the youth organizations and the religious organization leaders. And we'd sit around and put problems that were affecting all of our lives. And so, you know, guys went, man, I don't want to work with him. He's a Muslim. I don't want to work with him. He's from the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. I don't want to work with him. He's a Native American. And man, that ain't what we come to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in your area that you're over, what are some of the issues that affect your lives negatively that need to be changed? Whether by us or by the administration. What are they? Put them on the table. You know, you from your area, put yours on the table. Now, we're not here to discuss our differences religiously, politically, socially, culturally, or, you know, if you're homosexual or gay, that's your business. That ain't what we come to talk about. We want to know what you're doing in your area of influence that would allow people to be able to improve their chances for surviving beyond prison.
So, in the California prisons, I mean, there's a really strong presence of white supremacist organizations.
Right.
And sometimes they, I mean, sometimes they could be an obstacle to that kind of thing.
Right. How,
what's the situation in regard to that in Alabama, and how did you address that?
Well, you know, we have the same thing. We have what is known an offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan called the Southern Brotherhood. You know, and a few other names they give themselves. Some of the Ku Klux Klan faction people, white supremacists, they'll infiltrate the Native American organization and pretend to be an Indian Native American so that they can have advantages of the opposition, the opportunity for isolating themselves from the rest of us, you know, on the Indian ground that they call them.
Oh, right, right.
The institution might set aside an area and put up a fence and designate that as a Native American area, and no one can go in there with so-called Native Americans. So we've had an issue with white supremacist type of people infiltrating the Indian Native American organization, claiming to be, you know, Native American for the sake of having that opportunity to do their thing inside the Native American ground. But we don't have a lot of, you know, racial antagonistic, hostile hostilities expressed among, you know, people in the population. Now, it depends. A lot of times it depends on how large the population is. You
know,
if there are more whites than there are black and brown people, then, you know, the white supremacists have a tendency to be a little bit more aggressive and a little more hostile. But for the most part, they have been, in Alabama, they have never really been in a predominantly controlling it type of environment where they could just do what they wanted to do, you know, like they do in some prisons around the country.
So, like, I mean, like in a prison, in the medium and high security yards in California, the space is segregated. So you got pull-up bars for blacks and pull-up bars for whites. And basketball court, one end for blacks and northern, other end.
See, they're still practicing
space.
Segregation.
So yeah.
We don't have a segregated atmosphere, you know.
Okay.
We overturned that in the late 60s.
Yeah. California, you know, likes to pretend it's liberal, but it's,
We won the right to have the prisons integrated in the late 60s. Matter of fact, my first mentor, who was a guy who had been released from death row, and he was fighting his convictions. And I used to sit upstairs in that block where they had murderers and rapists and robbers, and call it the Capitol block in jail. And the guys up there, I used to work in the kitchen. So I used to hustle sandwiches and get them over there to them.
Sure,
and
sure.
So that was my hustle. But it also gave me an opportunity to go around the prison, and I mean the jail. And so guys used to have a lot of books, and well, in animal westerns. And so I used to sit upstairs to get me something to read, and they sent me down over our westerns. But this particular guy, his name was Caleb Washington, and he won litigation in the late 60s called Washington versus State of Alabama. And in that, he challenged the fact that the Alabama prison system was segregated. No black employees were there, and you had white prisons and black prisons and what have you. So he won that case before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ordered the Department of Corrections to integrate their prisons. Mm-hmm. And of course, they didn't always do that fully. They did it by, like, how you just described with California.
Yeah.
They had whites in the prison, but they had a black dormitory over here and a white dormitory mm-hmm. over there, but they were not living together.
Yeah.
Now, they walked through the prison halls and what have you, go eat and what have you, together.
Right.
You know, go out on the yard, and there were no segregated facilities for their exercise, you know, no white, black area, you know, they all had to commingle together. But over time, even that was eliminated, and they began to integrate. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
You know, the dorms, programs, and there was no black program, white program, except maybe religiously speaking.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the religious organizations generally were catering to, you know, the Islamic community, of course, was all black. Now, the Sunni community, which is Orthodox Islam, had a few white members there from time to time. Mm-hmm. But the Nation of Islam was all black. And Moore Science was all black. And, you know, Five Percenters was all black. But they, over time, they began to integrate because they had youth organizations that had infiltrated their groups, and so they, you know, they had things going on that benefited them in that way. But
so you think if they, I mean, if they're having a strike now, that there won't be a problem of whites like not participating in the strike because so the Free Alabama Movement has some white members as well.
Yeah, you know, the organizations of that nature deal with everybody.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't just all black, all white. They bring everybody in the prison together as best they can, you know, when they're doing stuff like that. Because, like I said, you know, when you put the issues on the table, your and my differences are not relevant.
Exactly. I mean, that was so crazy about the California system trying to get people together, and then
Well, that was one of the other things. The other skill sets that I had, you know, being able to build relationships with people across racial, ethnic, religious lines. And, you know, I was able to bring the Nation of Islam and the Sunni community and the Five Percenters and youth organizations or whatever, Gangster Disciples or Vice Lords or Bloods and Crips. I was able to bring all of them together, you know, because I had gained respect over time. And so whenever I was spearheading an event or a program or initiating an opportunity for a strike or something, I brought in all the leaders from all the different groups, and we sit around the table and we talked about those problems that we had within the prison. If I was creating law classes to develop the skills of individuals who might be able to help me with the litigating for the prison or against the prison, then I would bring the different leaders from the groups and tell them that they have potential candidates for taking on law classes. And so each one of those leaders would send me 2, 3, four,
and they'd
five
see the benefit
people.
Of it for their group,
right.
Yeah.
And so with my reputation having become what it had when it comes to law, nobody second-guessed me on what I had planned, and they respected my ability to bring into reality the opportunity for people in their little community to have law skills, so that whenever they were being under attack by the administration, they would have individuals in their little group who had been taught law, and how to write petitions and suits and lawsuits, and how to go study and research the material they needed to protect their organization from attack by the administration, because they are, from time to time, the administration would attack, you know, one organization or another. Sometimes they brought it on themselves by doing stupid stuff and getting caught. But for the most part, they I was able to create a lot of jailhouse lawyers.
Yeah.
Whenever the administration was told or they observed that I had brought together a group of individuals and they were applying themselves to suing the state or suing for one thing or another, then they would bust us up, ship us to other prisons. And so I used to think it was funny. It was, what you laugh about, Seku? I said, they think by splitting us up, shipping us out to other prisons, that they're hurting us. But what they were doing was giving us an opportunity to start the same process over in another prison. And so in doing so, over the years, people who used to come to my classes and that I had maybe twice a week, lectures, study classes, study groups, or whatever we were doing, workshops, then when they leave that institution and go to another one, they would start doing
the same thing,
you know, creating their own opportunities for building organizations to carry on the work.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what has happened with the new and now influential Free Alabama movement. Some of the members and leaders of those groups were once students in my groups in other prisons.
Okay.
And so when they got transferred out, they began to do the same thing.
I want to ask you one more question, but I just want to double check, make sure this thing's going okay. So that was, I mean, you were kind of leading up to what I wanted to ask you about it. So to what extent do you think some of the, you know, political education work that you did over the years and just general education work over the years sort of provided, laid a groundwork or a foundation or fed in to the kind of strike action that we see now in the prison system?
Right, because, you know, like I said, in the early years, late 60s, early 70s, when I wasn't on the skate and was in the system, you know, there were situations, there were times when we would have to challenge administration for a change in conditions or improvement on the environment, and they would want to refuse, you know, the hell with y'all. And so we'd have to, you know, organize hunger strikes. So we would go from group to group, bring in the leaders, let them know what was on the table, what we needed to do, and time frame within which we wanted to do it, and then send them out in their areas of influence around the prison and let them sit down and educate people, bring their consciousness up to understand what it was expected of them, needed of them, required of them for us to be able to be successful.
This has been Kite Line. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, Kite Line Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. Kite Line wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message or share a story to be played on the air at 812-269-2517. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one. You can find previous episodes of KiteLine or more information on our stories at kitelineradio.noblogs.org. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across the prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. to hear more stories, news, and insights about Indiana's prison system and its impact on our communities. Thank you for listening.